The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Story told about three people, a doctor, an architect, and a lawyer, were discussing their respective professions and arguing as to which one of them had the oldest of the three professions. The doctor pointed out that on the sixth day of creation, God performed surgery on Adam to make Eve, even gave him an anesthetic and put him to sleep, and therefore doctoring goes back to the sixth day of creation. Whereupon the architect said, well, yes, but what happened 6 days before then? God created the entire universe. That's the greatest architectural feat of all kind. Therefore, architecture predates medicine and surgery by 6 days. The lawyer said, yeah, but what was there before the universe was created? It was chaos. Only a lawyer could do that. So today, we're going to talk about chaos. Actually, we're going to be addressing the question in many people's minds that there's a contradiction somehow between science and Torah. And perhaps there is nowhere where we find the differences to be more irreconcilable than in the story of creation. To make it very, very simple, there are many reasons why there appear to be contradictions, but perhaps the simplest one is concerning the age of the universe. Namely, according to the Torah, it's 5,752 years old, and according to the best estimates of science, it's somewhere in the order of about 10 to 20 billion years old. Now, one can argue about whether various dating techniques are accurate, carbon-14 dating, and it's true, there are inaccuracies. However, the fact of the matter is that there is no way that those inaccuracies are going to be able to account for the difference between some 5,700 years and several billion years. So what I'm going to do this afternoon is, number one, to construct a logical argument that will show you that there is absolutely no contradiction at all between Torah and science in terms of the age of the universe. But I'm actually going to do more. Since science is something which strives for truth, and since Torah is truth, it would make sense that the more science learns and the better we understand what science has been finding, and the better that we understand the Torah, the more we're going to see that rather than divergence, we find convergence. They're almost identical. We're going to find that there are things which our Chazal have told us, going back thousands of years, which could make absolutely no sense except in terms of discoveries that have been made over the last 10 or 20 years. Now, there is a danger in doing that. And the danger is, you may say, well, fine, you know, so this is what science says today. Perhaps 10 years from now or 5 years from now, science will say something somewhat different. Science does change. It's the point of view of the best information we have at the present time. What I will be discussing with you are not going to be esoteric theories. I'm going to be discussing mainline science. This is the things that the great majority of scientists believe today because there's quite a bit of evidence to indicate that they are true. That isn't to say, though, that there may not be some refinements and some changes. Well, what happens if they come up with changes? And 5 years from now, you say, well, wait a minute, does that mean the Torah is wrong? Because after all, 5 years ago, Mr. Gans told me that the Torah and the science of that day were the same. And now you see science changes, so now the Torah must be false. And the answer is no. The reason is because what I'm going to be doing is constructing a model of creation. I am not going to be able to tell you how creation took place because no one knows. But I will construct a model of how creation might have taken place in such a way that this model is completely in accord with the latest scientific findings, and simultaneously it is also in complete agreement, in each case with at least one of the accepted mefarshim on the Chumash. Now, that isn't to say this is the truth, but the point is this. My point is that if you can construct a model which is consistent under both Torah and science, what it means is that it can be no contradiction. If the two are contradictory, you couldn't find the model that would satisfy both. So please bear that in mind. I'm going to give you a possible way in which the universe might have been created, which is consistent with Torah and science. I'm not going to tell you this is the way it actually must have happened, although if you want my own personal opinion, it probably will be fairly close. But there may be some differences, and we'll find out about these differences as the years go by and science refines its findings. Okay, so does everyone understand the basic idea of what we're going to try to do? All right, so start off with science. In the 20th century, there were basically two theories about the nature of our universe. The first one was the steady state theory. As a matter of fact, this theory is not only the 20th century, it goes back to ancient Greece. The steady state theory says that the universe is the same everywhere. It's steady state. In other words, if I have a telescope and I have to look way, way at the other end of the universe in this direction, way, way in that direction, I would basically see the same thing. Not exactly the same thing, but I'd see the same kind of stars, the same kind of galaxies. Basically, wherever you look, it looks pretty much the same. But it goes deeper than that. What it also says is that the universe is steady state, not only everywhere, but every when. That is to say, if I had a time machine and I can look a billion years into the past or a billion years into the future, I would also see the same universe, basically. According to the steady state theory, the universe has always been here. It's a very easy answer to the question of where did the universe come from. It didn't come from anywhere. It's always been here. In contradiction to this, in 1948, George Gamow propounded a new theory, which eventually was called the Big Bang Theory. And he said, no, the universe has not always been here. There was a particular point in time, which he estimated as being somewhere between 10 and 20 billion years ago, in which the universe was some kind of a primordial egg. And we're going to discuss later the nature of this primordial egg. And this primordial egg exploded, and our entire universe is a result of that incredible explosion. Now, these two theories vied with each other for a while until 1963. In 1963, Martin Schmidt discovered something called quasars. Now, quasars had actually been seen before. They looked to be ordinary stars. What they discovered was that, no, they were not ordinary stars because they were at the very, very edge of the observable universe. You could see quasars no matter which direction you look. You could look all the way there, all the way there. Wherever you look, you'll find quasars, but never in the vicinity of our own galaxy. They were always very, very far away. Well, that means that these quasars must be extraordinary objects, because if they are billions of times farther away than a star, and yet it has the same apparent brightness as a star, it, in fact, must be generating tremendous amounts of energy to burn that brightly. As a matter of fact, a single quasar can give off more light than 100 galaxies, each galaxy of which can have hundreds of millions of stars. One quasar. Well, this was a contradiction to steady state, because steady state says the universe is the same everywhere, and now you discover the universe is not the same everywhere. Far away there are quasars, nearby there are no quasars. But again, it goes deeper than that. To understand this, we have to understand the nature of light. We usually think of light as being something which happens simultaneously everywhere. You turn a switch, the room is flooded with light immediately. But the fact of the matter is that light travels at a finite velocity. It's very, very fast, which is why it appears to be instantaneous. But in fact, it has a finite velocity of 186,281.7 miles per second. Now, that means, for example, that when I am looking at the sun, I am not seeing the sun as it exists right now. I'm seeing the sun as it existed approximately 7.9 minutes ago, because it takes about 7.9 minutes for the light to travel the 92,700,000 miles from the sun to the earth at a speed of 186,281.7 miles per second. So that if the sun were chas v'shalom to explode, we wouldn't know about it for about 8 minutes. The moon, on the other hand, is much closer. It's only about a quarter of a million miles away, and it takes a couple of seconds for the light to reach us from the moon. So what this is saying, then, is that the further away something is, the further back in time you are looking, because it takes that much longer for the light to get from whatever object that is to where I am observing it. So what this is saying is, here is the reason why you see no quasars in the general vicinity of the Earth. They're only very, very far away. You see, there are no quasars anymore. The quasars burn energy at such a prodigious rate that they've all burnt out. Once upon a time in the universe, there were quasars. There were quasars near the Earth, and there were quasars very, very far away. However, they all burnt out, and there are no longer any quasars near the Earth, and you don't see them. And there are also no longer any quasars far away. But the light that left those quasars several billion years ago is first arriving on the Earth today, and that's what we're seeing. So what it's saying is that the universe is also not steady state through time. It is evolving. In the early universe, there were quasars. In the present-day universe, it appears that there are no quasars, although we'll come back to this again later. Again, in 1963, Penzias and Wilson of the Bell Telephone Labs discovered, they pointed a radio antenna at the sky, and they discovered what's called the cosmic background radiation. This is the actual radiation which is a result of the Big Bang itself. It's sort of a leftover, if you will, of the actual explosion that formed our universe. And so, at that point in time, having discovered the actual background radiation of the Big Bang itself, which, by the way, was not predicted by the proponents of the Big Bang theory. It was predicted by the proponents of the steady state theory, saying that if your theory was right, there ought to be a background radiation. No one's found it. But they didn't. They did find it in 1963. And so we have Carl Sagan, for example, in his book Cosmos, and I quote, 10 or 20 billion years ago, something happened. The Big Bang. The event that began our universe. Why it happened is the greatest mystery we know. Now, it's not clear yet why it's such a great mystery, but we'll come back to that later. That it happened is reasonably certain. All the matter and energy now in the universe was concentrated at extremely high density, a kind of cosmic egg, reminiscent of the creation myths of many cultures. Perhaps into a mathematical point with no dimension at all. Remember that. A mathematical point with no dimension at all. We're going to come back to that point, literally, again later. Astronomy magazine, May 1987, article on the Big Bang, and I quote, was there light? Since the majority of photons, now photons are particles of light, may not have been created until a small fraction of a second after the Big Bang, it is quite possible that a universe was born out of darkness rather than in a blinding flash of light. Remember that now, a universe born in darkness. We'll come back to that again later also. All that would have existed in the darkness was the empty space out of which our 10-dimensional space-time later emerged. Now, here we have a chart from the Scientific American, June 1988, a chart of the events that happened after the Big Bang. This is the Big Bang right over here. And you will notice over here, this arrow right over here, photons uncouple from matter. Now, photons are particles of light. So photons uncouple from matter says that no, there was no sun, there were no stars yet, no stars, no sun, but photons, particles of light, are simply appearing as an ambient light throughout the universe. Here we have, again, the New York Times science section, August 8, 1989, where it actually gives a chronology of events, ABT, after the beginning of time. Because you see, according to science, time was also created with the universe. There was no time before the universe was created. So there was not only a creation of space, there was also a creation of time. And right over here, you have photons uncoupled from matter, 1 million years ABT, 1 million years after the beginning of time. The next question that came up was, given that we have a universe which is expanding, which is came from a Big Bang at some time in the past, what kind of a universe is it? Is it a closed universe or is it an open universe? Let me explain the difference. Supposing I have a ball in my hand, and let's assume there's no ceiling above me, and I throw the ball up, what's going to happen to that ball? It's going to come back down again, right? As a matter of fact, it's going to go up, it's going to go slower, 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 until it eventually stops, and then it's going to begin to fall back again. The same thing is also can also be true of the universe. There was this explosion in which all of the matter of the universe expanded. Now, if there was not enough energy in that explosion, and there's too much gravitational attraction due to all the mass in the universe, it will expand slower, 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 and eventually stop, and then begin to fall back in on itself in what is called the Big Crunch. And it'll eventually get very, very hot when it's compressed, and it will explode again. And so what we have is not a steady-state universe, but perhaps an infinite succession of universes, one after the other, expanding and contracting, expanding and contracting. According to this theory, again, the answer to the question of where did our universe come from is a very simple one. Our universe came from the collapse of the universe that was here before us. And where what's going to happen to us will eventually collapse and form the universe that will come after us. On the other hand, supposing when I throw that ball up, supposing I'm the kind of a guy who can rip open his shirt and there's a big S in there, right? Now, if I throw that ball with enough force, namely the escape velocity from the Earth, which is approximately 7 miles per second, that ball will never come back again. It'll go slower and slower and slower, but it'll never slow down to the point where it begins to fall back again. It will completely escape from the Earth's gravitational attraction. And so it is also with the universe. If there was enough energy in that primordial explosion and not enough mass to force the gravitational attraction to force it back again, it will keep on expanding slower and slower, but it will never stop expanding. It'll just expand forever. An open universe implies a unique creation. If the universe is closed, it could have come from the collapse of a previous universe. If the universe is open, it came from nothing. And here's why. Consider the ball again. Supposing I drop it. I don't throw it. I drop it on the floor. With each successive bounce, is the ball going to go higher or lower? It's going to go higher, right? No. It's going to go lower. Good. Just check and make sure you're awake. Okay, the ball is going to go lower each time because it's losing energy. And so it is also with the universe. With each explosion, if it's going to come back again, with each explosion, it can never explode more, it can never go more than it did on the previous explosion because all the energy in this bounce came from the previous bounce. Now, unlike the ball, it also may not lose energy. So it's not clear that it will bounce less, but certainly will not bounce more because there's no new energy being added into the explosion. So what you'll either have is a universe exploding, contracting, and exploding over and over again, or if the universe has enough energy to keep on going forever, it could not have come from a closed universe. A big bounce does not come after a small bounce. An open universe never comes after a closed universe. A closed universe cannot give birth to an open universe. So if the universe is open, it means it came from nothing, from absolute nothingness. In 1972, measurements of a chemical called deuterium in space indicated, but did not prove conclusively, that the universe appears to be an open universe rather than a closed universe. That was one of the first pieces of information, of evidence, for an open universe. In 1979, they succeeded in measuring the actual expansion rate of the universe itself. And here we have the McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Science and Technology. And what you have over here are the measurements of the recession velocities of very, very distant quasars and galaxies. And what you find is the following. This line going on the bottom over here, this is what would happen, this is what you'd measure if, in fact, the universe was steady state. If the universe was a closed universe, you'd expect to see the measurements in the gray area on the top of the white. On the other hand, if it's an open universe, you expect to find it along this line right over here, and the dots represent the measurements. Notice that for very close galaxies and quasars, you can't tell the difference. But as you get further and further out, it's very clear that the measurements are going right along the open universe and are certainly staying very far away from the closed universe, as well as also far away from the steady-state universe. Well, scientists, not science, sometimes have a problem with that. And it's perhaps phrased best of all by the physicist Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking, a British physicist, is one of the greatest physicists. He's considered perhaps the best physicist since Albert Einstein. He has a degenerative nerve disease, and he can't even talk anymore. He can only manipulate a computer with one finger, and that's how he communicates with people. He recently published a book. It was a bestseller. It's called A Brief History of Time, From the Big Bang to Black Holes. And in it, he makes the following interesting comment, and I quote, "Many people do not like the idea that time has a beginning, probably because it smacks of divine intervention. However, a beginning indeed did the universe have." If we take a look, New Scientist, 30 June 1988, they report that measurements of a chemical called lithium also indicate that the universe is an open universe rather than a closed universe. Measurements of dark matter, that is, matter that cannot be seen in the universe because it doesn't give off any light. Measurements of dark matter, found through a variety of other techniques, reported in Astronomy Magazine, March 1988, again indicate the universe is an open universe. Lensing effects, something predicted by Albert Einstein 50 years ago. This is a single galaxy, but its image is split, and a little bit of a halo over here. It's being split by the gravitational attraction of something, we don't know what it is, but some unseen dark matter in between this object and us. By looking at these lensing effects throughout the universe, one can make an estimate of how much dark matter there is, according to how many times we see this lensing. It's called an Einstein ring. Again, reported Astronomy Magazine, November 1988, again indicate the universe is an open universe rather than a closed universe. New Scientist, 9 June 1988. Measurements of the number of helium-burning stars again indicate the universe is an open universe rather than a closed universe. And most recently, going back to the very first thing, deuterium, but very, very precise measurements of the amount of deuterium in the universe made by the Hubble Space Telescope, this was one of the things that was not affected by its bad eyesight, indicate again that the universe is an open universe. That was reported in January 1992. So what we have then is science saying that the universe has not existed forever. There was some kind of a primordial egg that came from absolutely nothing, which exploded to form the universe that we have today. That's science talking. And not only that, the universe started off in darkness, not in light. Let's spend a few minutes now and try to understand the nature of the cosmic egg from which our universe came. And to understand that, we have to go a little bit into stellar evolution. That is, what happens to a star when it dies? Now, if we take a star like our sun, for example, it's not terribly interesting unless you happen to be on the planet that depends on it for life. But what happens is that slowly, as the nuclear fires burn out, the star begins to cool. And as it cools down, it begins to contract because the heat of the star has been counteracting the gravitational attraction of all its mass. So it becomes compressed. And it would eventually become something called a white dwarf star. It can be a million times denser than water, which is to say that a cubic inch of a white dwarf, if brought over here on Earth, would weigh approximately 7 tons. Very strange object, but basically nothing more than a so-called a dying ember in space, if you will. However, supposing the star is much bigger. In particular, it has to be at least 3 times the size of our sun. This is almost a magical point called the Chandrasekhar limit. If the star, the mass of the star is beyond the Chandrasekhar limit, then something very special happens. True, the star becomes a white dwarf, but it does more than that. Because what happens is after it's become a white dwarf, the gravitational attraction of so much mass is so powerful that it can overpower the electromagnetic force which holds the electron spinning around the atoms. And so it no longer has atoms, but the atoms get squished together, and it becomes even more compact into something called the neutron star. But the gravitational attraction is still powerful. It's even more powerful than the nuclear force which holds together the nucleus of the atoms. And therefore, it continues to contract, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it vanishes. It disappears. It becomes something called a black hole. A mathematical point. Remember the mathematical point from before? Actually, we have no way to tell for sure it's a mathematical point, that it becomes as close to a mathematical point as anything in the physical universe can become. I think it's probably a more accurate way to say it. Now, the black hole is called black because the gravitational attraction is so powerful that even light cannot escape from it, and therefore it's called black. Now, at a certain distance from the black hole, there is an imaginary surface at a distance called the Schwarzschild radius. It's called the event horizon. Now, the event horizon is the point of no return. Supposing you were in a spaceship heading toward a black hole. Now, I say you because I wouldn't do it. But if you were in a spaceship heading toward a black hole, then until you've come to the event horizon, theoretically, you can turn your engines around, and if they're powerful enough, you can fire them and escape from the gravitational pull of that black hole. However, once you have gone through the event horizon, it is absolutely impossible for you to ever come back out again. Now notice, I did not say that we do not know how to get out. I did not say that it is technologically infeasible to get out. What I said is that we can prove that it is mathematically impossible to get out, because it requires an infinite amount of energy to extract a single particle from inside the event horizon of a black hole to outside the event horizon. This is a direct consequence of the equations of relativity. It requires an infinite amount of energy to take a single particle out of a black hole. Let's talk a little bit more about black holes. Supposing I have my favorite enemy. Now, this is a guy who has been bugging me my entire life, and I've been trying to get rid of him, and no matter what I do, he always seems to come back. And so one day I tie him up into a spaceboat, point him at a black hole, and give it a little push. And I know that once that spaceball goes through the event horizon, there is no way he's ever going to come back, even if he's James Bond. Well, I'm watching the spaceboat heading toward the black hole. It's going faster and faster and faster, accelerating toward the event horizon. And then somehow it seems to be slowing down. And it's going slower and slower. Well, I'm getting hungry. I figure I'll go have my dinner. I come back from dinner. I can come back 1,000 years later, and I will still see that spaceboat approaching the event horizon. It will be very dim. It will take on a reddish hue. This is called the infinite redshift. What's really happening? I'm going to give you two explanations for what is actually going on. The first explanation is going to be very, very simple to understand. However, it's going to be false. The second explanation is going to be correct, but it's going to require that you stretch your minds a little bit to believe and understand it. First explanation. The spaceboat is approaching the event horizon, and the light is leaving that spaceboat and heading back toward my observatory. But the gravitational attraction of the black hole is so powerful that it's holding back that light, and the light is sort of struggling to get out. It's going very slowly. So you see, the spaceboat really went in a long time ago, but it's the image of the spaceboat, the light that left that spaceboat just before it went into the event horizon, that's coming out very, very slowly because the gravity is holding it back until eventually it gets far enough away and it speeds up to its normal speed, and then I see it. Sounds perfectly reasonable, doesn't it? No, you're not going to say it's reasonable. I already told you it's wrong. You know what's wrong with it? What's wrong with it is that light cannot travel slowly. Light always travels at 186,281.7 miles per second in a vacuum. Now the real explanation. We usually think of time as being the same everywhere in the universe. Time is time. Time flows, but it's not true. Relativity theory again teaches us that time can move at different velocities, so to speak, in different parts of the universe. In particular, in the presence of a gravitational field, time slows down. The stronger the gravitational field, the more time slows down. Now, this is not just theory. This has been experimentally verified over and over and over again, and it goes exactly according to the equations of relativity theory. What's happening is the following. True, the spaceboat went into the black hole a long time ago. But the light that left that spaceboat is coming out at 186,000 miles a second. But a second is no longer a second. It's going through a time warp. The point over here is something that happened very, very quickly in one place can appear to happen very, very slowly in a different time reference. Very important point, and a result of general relativity. Well, how do we know that black holes actually exist? Would you like to see a picture of a black hole, anyone? I've been waiting for years for the audience, which would unanimously say that they didn't want to see the picture. I think the problem was that I've never lectured to a non-Jewish audience. With Jewish audiences, you never get a complete opinion on anything, unanimous opinion. Heart of Darkness. This is the great spiral galaxy called Andromeda. For those who want to be more precise, in the catalog number M33. There is increasing evidence that the familiar Andromeda galaxy harbors an ultra-massive black hole at its center, a behemoth more than 10 times as big as the million solar mass hole thought to lurk in our own galactic core. 10 million times the mass of the sun. Of course, you can't see it because it's black. A little bit disappointing. I can, however, show you a simulation that was done on a computer at the University of Chicago and reported in the Scientific American. Here you can actually see this black circle over here is the event horizon of the black hole. And these little arrows around it are indicating the path that matter would take as it spirals into the black hole. But the fact of the matter is, we don't have to rely solely on computer simulations. Cygnus X1. An ordinary star through an ordinary telescope. But there's something very peculiar about Cygnus X1. You see, it's revolving around something. But when you look to see what is it revolving around, you don't see anything there. It takes 5.6 days for Cygnus X1 to make one revolution, which implies that the mass of the object that it's going around is 3.4 times the mass of our sun. Remember, the Chandrasekhar limit is 3. So therefore, the mass of this unseen object is beyond the Chandrasekhar limit. And therefore, mathematically, it must be a black hole. It even has a name, a very, very nice mnemonic name that's very easy to remember. It's called HDE226868. But you see, Cygnus S1 is not going around HDE226868 quietly. Because while it's doing so, the mass from that star is being sucked in by the black hole. It's being pulled out, and as it goes rushing into the black hole, it gives off tremendous amounts of energy before it hits the event horizon. And so, Cygnus X1, an ordinary star through an ordinary telescope. However, a photograph of the X-ray sky showing the bright source, Cygnus X1, a probable black hole, an image from the High Energy Astrophysical Observatory 2 in Earth orbit. Notice, by the way, that in this particular time frame, which is January 1988, it's called the probable black hole. That was because they only found X-rays coming out of there. More recently, it was reported that they also detected gamma rays coming out. And gamma rays could only come from a black hole. So mathematically, there's only one thing that can be right next to Cygnus X1, and that is a black hole. As a matter of fact, IRIS, the infrared astronomical satellite, has detected galaxies in collision. Here's one picture of them. Two galaxies that are in the process of actually colliding. And what's happened is they found that one of them has black holes in it, and what's happening is that the other is introducing matter into the vicinity of a black hole. Now you see, the black holes are what's left over of quasars. Or rather, I should say, quasars are really black holes. Because you see, what you have is the following. You have a black hole, and it's sucking in all the matter around it. And as all this matter is being concentrated, heading into the black hole, it gets very, very hot, and it gives off tremendous energy, and that's the quasar. It's giving off this energy before it comes to the event horizon. Eventually, the black hole has eaten up everything around it, and there's nothing left to go into it, in which case the quasar blinks out of existence, because it's now a black hole and you can't see it. But what happens when another galaxy comes moving in and introduces new matter into the area of the black hole? The quasar ignites again. It's now sucking in matter again, and again it becomes like a quasar. It's not as easy to see, which is why they thought there were no quasars nearby. There are new quasars, but they're hidden inside the collision of these two galaxies behind the gas. It took an infrared satellite in order to be able to detect it. As a matter of fact, in those galaxies that are colliding, they have actually measured the velocity at which matter is falling into the black hole. It's falling in at a velocity of 11 million miles an hour. Just imagine the traffic cop up there, huh? So we then come to the point now where we can begin to understand why Carl Sagan says that this is the greatest mystery we know. As a matter of fact, there's a whole bunch of incredible mysteries, unanswerable questions. We're just going to address two of them. The first one is very clear. If this is an open universe, it did not come from a closed universe. It didn't come from anything. It came from nothing. Who put us here? Why is it that there was absolutely nothing? There was no space, there was no time, and suddenly, out of nothing, a universe popped into existence. Who made it happen? Science has no answer to that question. As a matter of fact, science declares that the answer to that question is outside the realm of science. Science declares that science begins 10 to the minus 43 of a second after the Big Bang. That's a decimal point and 43 zeros and a one of a second. Before that, science says that's outside of the realm of science. We do not know and we cannot know what happened there. What we do have is that somehow our universe came into existence out of absolutely nothing. Now, the second unanswerable question is a little bit more subtle. But we are now in a position to understand what the primordial egg was. Because after all, if I take three times the mass of our sun and put it in one place, it forms a black hole. What do you suppose would happen if I took the entire universe and put it all in one place? It would form the granddaddy of all black holes. So we now understand that the primordial egg that our universe came from was in fact a black hole. But remember, it takes an infinite amount of energy to extract a single particle out of the black hole, let alone an entire universe. Where did that infinite amount of energy come from? It didn't come from within the universe because the universe didn't exist yet. And in any case, the universe is finite. So what science is saying is that it appears that, number one, something came into existence out of absolute nothingness, and number two, stage number two, was that an infinite amount of energy, totally unlimited, an infinite amount of energy from outside of the universe caused the black hole to expand to form the universe that we know today. That is science. Science Digest, October 1985, the 20 greatest unanswered questions of science. What do you suppose one of those questions would be? Anyone want to hazard a guess? Yeah, the universe. How did it begin? And I quote, "The astrophysicist's version is remarkably close to the first few lines of Genesis. In the beginning, there was nothing. No matter, no energy, no time, no space, a vacuum without shape or form. And then, for no reason, the vacuum flickered and time began. The idea that something can arise from nothing is anathema to our common sense. And even if it happened, the singularity lasted for an immeasurably short moment, and then gravitational repulsion, unknown in the modern universe, forced the singularity to expand like a black hole in reverse." Notice, they have to invent gravitational repulsion, something which has never been seen in the universe, to explain how this black hole happened. But you see, that was back in 1985. Nowadays, American scientists reported September, October 1988, measurements of lithium-7, helium-3, helium-4, and deuterium. All of them indicate that the critical density of the universe is way too low for that. In other words, if there had been gravitational repulsion, then all these measurements should fall in a line that would be where this arrow is. But instead, they fall over here. They're off by a factor of 10. The universe should not be an open universe, according to the theory of gravitational repulsion. It's what's called a flat universe. It's sort of like the borderline right between being closed and being open. This is the borderline right over here. We're off by a factor of 10 from the borderline. So today we know, no, there was no gravitational repulsion. And yet, nevertheless, we still had a black hole expanding, something which is absolutely mathematically and physically impossible. Okay, having taken a look at what science has to say about the creation of the universe, let's take a look and see what the Torah's view is. We start from the very, very beginning, Genesis chapter 1, sentence 1. In the beginning, didn't I just read that? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim v'sa'aretz. Now, first God. God, Elohim. There are many different names that we can use for God. Elohim is the name that's used actually in two contexts which are really very, very similar. One of them is that this is the God of nature, the natural God. This is the God of nature. He's creating nature. It also has the connotation of tremendous power. As a matter of fact, later on in Sefer Bereishis, it talks about other beings who are called El Bnei Elohim, and it's not talking about God. It's talking about the sons of very powerful people. So what the Torah is telling us, that a very powerful God, perhaps with an infinite amount of energy, created the universe. The heavens, that, we'll put that aside, that's the spiritual spheres. We're not talking about the spiritual, we're talking about the scientific, physical universe. Earth created the heavens and the earth. What was really created here? It was not the earth that we're sitting on right now, because the earth didn't exist yet. Says the Malbim, one of the classical commentators of about 100 years ago, and the Akedas Yitzchak, written by Rabbi Yitzchak Arama of the 15th century, they say that earth refers over here to the entire physical universe. In other words, the Torah is saying the physical universe was created by God. In the beginning, he created the physical universe. Makes perfectly good sense. He created space, if you will. Create. In English, we can say, I've created this beautiful painting. I've created this beautiful sculpture. But not so in Hebrew. In Hebrew, the word bara is a very, very special word. And as a matter of fact, you will find that it's used only in three contexts in the entire story of the creation of the universe. The first connotation, the first place it's used, is in the actual creation of the universe from nothing. The second one is in the creation of animate life, and the third is in the creation of the soul of man. I might point out to you that the first two are the only things, basically, that science does not have any grasp at all. It's completely outside of the bounds of science. And the third one is something which scientists don't discuss because they don't talk about the soul. Science only talks about those things which can be measured, observed, weighed, grown in a Petri dish. That doesn't apply to soul. The word bara means specifically to create something that's absolutely new, that never existed before, out of absolute nothingness. That's bara. Everything else, aside from those three places I told you, are Vayomer Elokim Yehi, something should happen, Naaseh, to make, to form something from something else, but not to create something out of nothing. The word bara means the universe was created out of nothing. So therefore, the very first sentence of Genesis tells us, if we want to use scientific lingo, you are living in an open universe. Bara implies an open universe. Remember, a closed universe doesn't come from nothing. It can come from a previous universe. Only the open universe comes from nothing. So by using the word bara, it's saying this is not a closed universe. You didn't come from a previous universe. You came from nothing. You are in an open universe. That's what we deduce from the very first sentence. And the earth was tohu and vohu, chaos and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Darkness. Our rabbis tell us, our sages tell us, that this darkness was not simply an absence of light. This darkness was an object, it was a physical object, it was a palpable darkness. It was a positive thing, not simply an absence of light. Where do we know of in the scientific universe, where do we know of something which is not simply dark, but is an object which is darkness? There's only one thing that we know of that fits the bill. A black hole. So I don't know what Chazal were thinking when they said, well, my Rebbe taught me that it was a palpable darkness. Because until about 20 years ago, no one had any idea of what palpable darkness might mean. But now we know exactly. That's exactly what it is. Nachmanides, Ramban, 12th, 13th century, says, bohu, void, but also bohu, in it is substance, a void in which is substance. Again, where do we find a void in which is substance? In which is something in there, but it's a void. Again, a black hole. The Zohar describes the original creation as a lamp of darkness. Now, what is a lamp of darkness? A lamp of darkness is not something simply which is dark. Because what does an ordinary lamp do? An ordinary lamp is not simply light. It exudes light. If there was darkness around it, it replaces the darkness with light. So what would be a lamp of darkness? A lamp of darkness would be something which, if there's light around it, it will exude darkness. It will replace the light with darkness. Again, there's only one thing like that, and that's a black hole. So the Zohar actually gives perhaps the best description in human language of a black hole that I've ever seen. Which should not be surprising, because the Zohar is telling you the way things really, really are in their essence. Rabbeinu Bachai brings down an interesting Medrash Tanchuma. The Medrash Tanchuma is talking about a conversation between Moses and God in the desert, during the 40 years they were in the desert. God says to Moses, I want you to assemble all the Israelites in front of the tent of meeting. And Moses says to God, but God, there are so many of them. How am I going to get millions of people in front of this little tent? And God says to him, Moses, don't you remember who you're talking to? I am the one who the universe was like the pupil of an eye, and I spread it forth from one end of the universe to the other. Now, if that doesn't sound like Big Bang, I don't know what does. Let me ask you a question, by the way. What color is the pupil of an eye? Regardless of what color the eye is. Black. And do you know physiologically what the pupil of the eye is? It's a hole in the eye. The pupil is a black hole. Cute, huh? Rabbeinu Bachai and the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra all say that the universe started as a tiny point that was expanded afterward. But if that's bohu, and tohu came before that, what's tohu? If Bohu was the original black hole, and it says Tohu and Bohu, so Tohu seems to have come before that, what does Tohu refer to? It says Rabbeinu Bechai, Tohu is not something physical. Tohu was, in a sense, the blueprint of creation, to anthropomorphize, in the mind of God. It was a conception of what our universe will be before the physical universe was created. But it wasn't simply a conception. It was not simply a mind construct. It was something which itself evolved into the physical universe itself. The blueprint that God created turned into the physical universe. Hirsch, Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, about 100 years ago, says, quote, he let his thoughts materialize. Professor Stephen Hawking makes an interesting comment in the book I quoted before. He says that if we allow imaginary time, imaginary numbers are, for those of you who have been through high school, you may remember, or maybe you just want to forget about it, imaginary numbers are a mathematical construct. They're numbers which are not real, they don't correspond to anything in the real universe, but they have it's a mathematical abstraction that you can manipulate with mathematical rules. What Stephen Hawking is saying is that if you trace the universe backwards in time, you eventually come together to the Big Bang. But using imaginary numbers, it's possible to go beyond the Big Bang. And what you come up on the other side is a complete universe with all the laws similar to our universe, except that all the equations are imaginary numbers. There's nothing real. It's a mathematical construct of what the universe is. And if you run it forward through the imaginary time, it comes to a Big Bang, and on the other side, out comes a physical universe. This is something that Stephen Hawking found. In the article in Scientific American, December 1991, an article called Quantum Cosmology and Creation, they actually show sort of a diagram of the expanding universe. This is the universe as it's getting bigger and bigger. This is the point of creation that we know of. Notice that down here it says imaginary time. Now there's a very important thing to notice over here, and that is that not only does the universe have a beginning, but even the blueprint of the universe, the mathematical universe, also has a beginning. It doesn't keep on going down forever. It comes to a rounded bottom over here. So what that's saying is that there were actually two creations. First, there was the creation of a mathematical construct, a mathematical abstraction of our universe. And at some period of something afterward, this imaginary universe, a mathematical construct, turned into the physical universe we know today. Perhaps this is the Tohu that Rabbeinu Bechai and Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch are referring to. The face of the deep. What's deep? Well, what's shallow? Shallow means it's easy to reach the bottom. Deep, you can't reach the bottom. What could be deeper than something which has no bottom? Again, a black hole. The Malbim says that the deep also refers to a state of matter in which all matter, all different kinds of matter, can come from that one single state. A novel concept. In other words, wood, gold, silver, it all comes from one primordial substance. Interestingly enough, the reverse is known to be true scientifically. And that is, it doesn't matter if you take 3 suns worth of silver, gold, or feathers, they form only one thing, and that's black hole. It doesn't form a black gold hole, or a black silver hole, or a black feather hole. It all becomes one black hole. What Malbim is saying is that this is the reverse of that. It was something that anything can go into, but it came out the other way, and from this primordial substance could come feathers and gold and silver and so forth and so on. And God said, let there be light. Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, let there be light. And God separated the light from the darkness. That is, he drew the light, he separated. What do you mean separate light from darkness? He drew the light out of the black hole. Something which requires an infinite amount of energy to do. But let me ask you a question. Why light? Why is light the second thing to be created? What's so important about light? Space, we understand. He had to create space. I mean, otherwise you don't have anything. But light? Why does he need light? Does God need light to create the universe? I mean, make sure he doesn't stub his toe on a planet? Says the Ramban, the creation of light is the creation of time. Light is time. Now that's very strange. Why is that? Why is light time? Think about it. Remember, as you get closer and closer to a black hole, to the event horizon of a black hole, time goes slower and slower, right? As the gravitational attraction increases, time goes slower and slower. Until in the limit, when you come to the event horizon, time stops. There is no time in a black hole. So, if the universe was a black hole, and there was nothing outside of the black hole, there's no time. And as soon as you draw the first particle outside of the event horizon, you have something outside, you now have time. So the creation of light must necessarily, simultaneously create time. You have a period of something between the creation of space and the creation of time. You have space, but no time. Black hole is the only place we know that. That's space, but no time. Now, this is according to the theory of relativity. Theory of relativity was in the late 1920s. How did the Ramban in the 13th century know that? How did the Ramban know in the 13th century something that we can only deduce based on relativity theory that Einstein discovered in the late 1920s? It's very simple. He learned it from his Rebbe. So now we ask the question, where did his Rebbe get it from? Come on, where did he get it from? He got it from his Rebbe, right? And his Rebbe got it from his Rebbe. How far back does it go? No. To Avraham Avinu. 3,700 years ago. Our tradition tells us that Avraham Avinu was the author, orally, of the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, which was only recorded in writing about 1,500 years ago. It's about the same time as the Gemara was written down. But it's credited to Avraham Avinu. It's definitely in writing 1,500 years ago. The Sefer Yetzirah, the book of, actually, to be more accurate, it's the book of formation, although it's usually translated as the book of creation. And in the Sefer Yetzirah, we find the following. There are 10 sefirot that are created with the 10 sayings of God. The first one is created when it says, Bereishis Bara Elokim. And that's the sefirah of Keser, crown, majesty of Hashem. The second one comes about when it says, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or. At that point in time, we get the sefirah of Chachma. Now, Chachma, if you want wisdom, means over here something very, very special. Chachma is knowledge which is not bounded by time. It's such an intense knowledge that you understand. It's a wisdom that completely beyond time. You understand. You look at a person, for example, with true Chachma, and you don't only see the person that's here now. You see everything that he's ever been, and you see anything he ever will be. And the reason is because Chachma was created before there was any time. Next, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Rokia, is the third sphera, is Bina. Bina is understanding. Understanding is like Chachma, except it's bounded by time. I understand you the way you are now. What you were last year, I don't know. What you'll be next year, I don't know. But I know what you are now. That's Bina. Why? Because Bina was constructed after there was time. So now let's take a look between these two events. What was the only physical event that happened? Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or. Vayar Elohim is Or Ki Tov. Vayavdel Elokim Bein Or Bein Lechosha. Vayikra Or Yom Vechosha Kara Laila. Vayi Era Vayi Boke Yom Echad. And then Vayomer Elokim Yehi Rokia. So the only physical event that happened was Vayavdel, that he separated. So from the Sefer Yetzirah 3,700 years ago, you can deduce that it's the separation of light from the darkness that creates time. Because before the separation, there was no time. After the separation, there was time. It took Albert Einstein in the 1920s to be able to explain to us scientifically what Avraham Avinu knew 3,700 years ago. What kind of light was this? It was not created. It was not a bara. It was created from previous stuff. As a matter of fact, we say it every morning in the Shacharis, in the Bracha, right? Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe. Yotzer or uvarei choshech. You formed the light, but you created the darkness. The darkness was a creation. The light was simply formed.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com or call toll-free in the U.S. 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.